This podcast is part of the Shareable Podcast Network. Learn more at shareable.fm. This is Rogue. I'm your host, Jeff Gibbard. Hello, my fellow superhumans. I'm Jeff Gibbard, broadcasting to you live from Shareable FM headquarters right here in sunny Philadelphia. And I am pumped to bring you another episode of Rogue, the only podcast where I don't just interview superheroes, I steal from them. Every episode, I bring on a guest who has a real-world superpower, a mindset, a craft, a way of being. And then I get close enough to break apart their unique ability so it can be understood, rebuilt, and stolen. I don't just ask questions. I go line by line through their operating system until it's yours for the taking. Listen to ignite your superhuman spark and leave powerful enough to change the world. Now, let's get to today's superpowered guest. Today, my guest is Doc John, the entrepreneur. Let's get to know them. John, welcome to the show.
Jeff, thanks so much for having me. John Wilson, Doc John, the entrepreneur here, and I'm stoked to share my superpower. I'm glad to be here.
I am stoked to steal your superpower. When this came through, I love this show because, you know, I can't remember who I was talking to. You're a podcaster yourself. We've done a podcast together, and a lot of podcasters I know really appreciate the fact that through a podcast, you get to just learn from really amazing people. And what I love about the show is I get to learn. This is what that show is. This show is about is to learn and steal other people's superpowers. And when yours came through, I was like, oh my God, well, that's one that I actually need. Even after being an entrepreneur since 2011, what you teach and what you're going to show us today is something that I think is so super important. So set us up. What is your superpower that we're going to talk about today?
Yeah, my superpower is to help accidental entrepreneurs to dream bigger and start smaller. And so I can break that up a little bit. But when I say accidental entrepreneur, this is someone who has a passion, a dream, an idea, a product, a service, skill, whatever. And they're like, I want to start a business. I have no idea where to start. And even once I get started, how do I grow it? How do I make sure I get paid? All those kinds of things. And so that's that accidental entrepreneur that I like to work with. I teach at a leading university. I teach entrepreneurship at Drexel University in Philadelphia.
Go Dragons. So,
let's go Dragons. All right. And so a lot of those accidental entrepreneurs are students. Some of them are not accidental. Some are saying, I want to be an entrepreneur. And some are saying, I want to be X. And I want to also know how to be able to really be fruitful and be able to support myself while I do it. And then, of course, in the kind of what I call the mid-career category, it's those that a lot of times it's individuals that are, they're in a job, they're in a good job, but they feel like there's something missing in their life. They want to start a new business. And a lot of times they'll call me and say, Doc John, I want to quit my job and start a business. And I say, okay, rule number one, we're right into it. Like, don't quit your day job. And so, then it's like, okay, let's get started. And so that's really my superpower, is to really help draw that out and to help put some energy and some systems behind that in ways that might take someone years or maybe a lifetime to figure out.
I love it. Okay. So let's go back to the original, like, one sentence description you gave at the very beginning, because I want to pick a piece of that, which is that you help people. Did you say it? You help people dream bigger and start smaller. Is that the way you phrase it?
Dream bigger and start smaller.
I love it. Okay. So I started my entrepreneurial journey. I wouldn't say it was accidental because I always knew I wanted to do it, but it started because I got laid off. You know what? No, it's being generous to myself. I was fired. And so I started my business over the weekend, and the very first day I tasted that sweet, sweet freedom, and I decided this was going to be the life for me. And that was in 2011, and I have never looked back, and I will never look back. But I always dreamed really big, and I always followed those big dreams with a lot of big, bold ideas. And the part that I was so excited about this is dream bigger and start smaller. So Talk about that as a particular pain point that accidental entrepreneurs or even whether I'm in that category of, like, you know, I got fired and that's how it happened, or, you know, I decided I wanted to start a thing, or I went into school knowing that I wanted to come out and do it. What is this bit about starting smaller? Why is that important?
Yeah, probably one of my favorite talks to give at any kind of conference or anything like that is the one I call Start Smaller. And so I'd start out with the question, how can you start smaller? And I ask it two or three times because I really want to get it in everyone's head. How can you start smaller? Because one of the things I see accidental entrepreneurs really mess up on is, and we'll get to, they often don't dream big enough, but a lot of times they start too big. And the reason for that is I think those that don't have a business, they'll look at a business that's similar to one they want to start and they'll say, okay, I just need to build that. And then I open the doors kind of thing. And so the problem with that is, it's really, really time consuming, expensive, energy consuming to get to that place where most businesses are when you first experience them. And so a lot of times someone will think, I have to do all that. Well, you may invest hundreds of thousands of dollars. You might invest hundreds or thousands of hours. You might invest all of your kind of mental energy and to the point that you're exhausted. And then you bring this product to the market and the market's like, eh. Right. And then you have a problem. You've blown your entire shot and you have nothing to show for it. So when I say start smaller, I'm like, a lot of times I'm like, start with a napkin sketch or, I always have on my desk here. I have these like, Ugg Monk, cards where like, this is like a really old one, but it's like, it's almost like a note card with an organization system, but just like start with like, draw it on that card or write like a statement about what it is. And like that, start with like a prototype is literally something you draw on a piece of paper, or just start your business is like open and start a Google folder. Just say my new business. I don't even need a name for it yet. So that's how small what I mean when I say start smaller is like start really small. And that's like, most people say, okay, well that's like getting started, but like, that's not my launch. It's like, well, there's the public launch, but it's almost like that decision to say like starting today, I am an entrepreneur. I am a business owner. I am a founder, whatever that statement is like. And then, like you said, that first day where it's like, taste that sweet, sweet freedom of like, that's your main thing. And I always say, but don't quit your day job because like, it's a long time from that moment until revenue starts rolling in the door or profit that you can use. So, but starting smaller means, what's the most fundamental thing you can build, test, show to a customer, introduce to a customer, to really prove like, okay, I'm on the right track.
Okay. So there's so much to unpack here. Just for the sake of the audience to level set. So like, not only do you do this, but you teach this. So like you get to come at this from two angles and you've seen a lot of people go through this process. And so I think there's a pretty clear picture of like, what does it cost you if you do this? If you don't start small, if you go too far down, it costs you a bunch of money. It costs you a bunch of time, a lot of frustration. And that's, that's the life of an entrepreneur is frustration, but like you want to try and avoid as much of it as you can. I guess I want to see if you can provide maybe some insight into the thinking that goes into why people don't do this. Cause it sounds, when you say it, it sounds so like almost obvious, like, oh, well you should have a plan, at least a basic plan before you leap into it. Right. And then some of what you said sounds a little bit like experiment, right? Like try a few things, maybe put up a landing page, see if there's any interest, talk to some people, see if they're interested. So like there's a little bit around that, like be playful with it, be experimental with it and have some sort of a plan. All sound like, well, yeah, obviously, but so much of the time that's not what happens, right? And you and I share this. We both love working with entrepreneurs. I love talking with entrepreneurs. Somebody who has an idea, I'm like, that's candy for me. Let's go. But we often see them like, okay, I'm going to stand up this website. I've got all the offers. I'm ready to go. I've got the LLC and like I'm in business and nobody wants what they have. So what's the mindset that stops people? Why is that happening, I guess? And how do you get people out of that so that they see that they should be thinking smaller and experimenting and things like that?
Yeah. Well, it's funny. You just went through a long laundry list of things. I would say, don't do that yet.
Yeah.
It's just like all those things, they're great. They're important and you will need to do them when you have a business, but you don't have to do them from the beginning. And it's better to figure out like who's a very specific customer with a very specific pain point that I can address in a way that they'll pay me for it. Until you have that figured out, all the other stuff is irrelevant. And so that's where I say start smaller. Like don't go with the big, like build everything out. Start with the most fundamental question of who needs me, who needs what I have, and how can I deliver that to them? So that's where that small experiment where I say like, it can be a Google folder where you just start, writing down some of your thoughts, or, now we have so many AI tools that we can interact with. I think it was Dwight Eisenhower who first said, plans are useless. Planning is everything. And so in a way, prototyping and iterating is the new planning. So, you know, there's a time and place for, you know, detailed strategic planning and infrastructure and setting all things up. But the first fundamental thing is, how do I just kind of create that first prototype? And a lot of times it's just like, hey, I want to build this thing that delivers value in this way. It's like, but you could probably do it manually, in which case you just like put a really low price out and go find the customer and say, hey, I'll give you this value for this amount of money. And maybe it's a dollar, you know, maybe it's something very, very basic. And you just do it, you know, it's like, and you know, for them, it's like their problem is solved. It's not scalable and it's not pretty. And it's not like, they're not going to be like, ooh, I'm going to tell all my friends. But if you're like, if in a minute they're like, wow, I'm really glad. I mean, for a dollar, that was really worth it. You know, then it's just, you're just talking about, okay, well, what would be the price point where you'd say, ah, it's just a little too much. It's not worth it. You know, all of a sudden you have these data points. It's like, okay, there's a real problem. I have a solution of sorts and someone's willing to pay a dollar for it. And then now the question is, are they willing to pay two or 10 or 50? You know, at what point where they say, ah, at this point, I'll just go either build my own or do something else. So that's really the, you know, where that very first experiment can be a conversation as much, or, you know, napkin sketch as much as an actual product.
I remember, so I'm, and we've talked about this, but for those who are listening, don't know, I graduated my MBA at Drexel. So big fan of the Drexel program. I learned a lot there. And I talk at great lengths about this, and I can't remember where I heard this and when in my journey I heard this, but I heard the someone say, your business plan is outdated the minute that you finish it, right? And similar to the idea of like, plans are useless, planning is everything. You know, I'm hearing you say that there's a value in doing some business planning, to thinking about what your business should be, asking some of those questions, trying to figure out like, well, what's the first thing I can solve for someone? And is there a pathway to turn that into something profitable? As someone who teaches in a, you know, in a university about business, about entrepreneurship, where do you start people on the conversation around business plans and business planning and how deep they should go and how much? Because you're saying back of the napkin, but then you can look at a business plan and there's all different formats of it, the standard format, the modern formats, et cetera. Yeah. Kind of where do you weigh in about like, where do you start with all of this stuff?
Yeah. So for me, I always start with the business model canvas from Strategizer, which is open source. Anybody can use it. Anybody can use it like for consulting, anything like that. Tied to the Lean Startup, but essentially it's a 9-box design panel kind of template that you can use to figure out your business. I always start there. So first year students, first course, I'm going to teach them how to use Business Model Canvas. And then I'm going to use it in every course that we do from there on out. I don't get into when we maybe need to define, what do you mean by business plan? Because when we think business plan, we think like 60 to 80 page document with charts and graphs and data and explanations and pictures and blah, blah, blah. And you put it in front of a banker and they look at it and say, well, this is complete crap. I'm not going to loan you any money. You know, just that's what we think of as a business plan. To me, it's like the business model canvas really helps you focus in on, there are 9 components of any business that really matter. And so you need to figure those out, and you don't just need to like spend 10 minutes and like fill in a word for each box. It's like every box will then come with, you know, 50, 100 assumptions. You have to test those assumptions. So all that work, you know, you can do it in minutes or hours or days. But what you're doing is you're fundamentally figuring out what is the business model. And then you're testing all the assumptions of that business model. And when you're done, when you get to the point where you actually have that really figured out and you've gotten customers to give you feedback to help you test those assumptions, you have everything you need. The 60, 80 page document, like that is now an AI exercise. I teach business, like what you would think of as like a formal business plan, about the third year in a 5-year program. So to give you an idea, about halfway through, and I exclusively teach to use a platform called LivePlan by Palo Alto Software. It's not the only one out there. I'm sure there are others. I'm not endorsing them. I'm not like backed by them, or I don't get any commissions for them or anything like that. But it's a great tool. And it used to be a really, really good tool to help you compile and input all your information. And now they've built AI tools, which make it really, really easy for anyone. Like, you don't have to have ever built a business plan to be able to take a really thoughtfully developed and assumption tested business model canvas and put it into Live Plan and get that beautiful 80-page document that even a banker is going to say, wow, this looks like really buttoned up and solid, and you look like you know what you're doing. So that's like, that's the whole thing, is it's not as hard as we often make it out to be in our heads. And that's where we get this thing of like, oh, I got to spend a year building a business plan. Well, that business plan is going to be outdated. I actually think it's outdated before it's finished, because
yeah,
components of it were built at a point where they're out of date by the time you get to the finish line. So it's,
yeah. So you've been doing this a long time, professionally as an educator, but also as someone who has been in the world of being an entrepreneur. You have your own things that you're working on, and you're an interesting guest, because you're going to be talking about this topic, I think, from two different sides. One of the things that I have noticed about people who have a superpower is that they often take it for granted because it comes easily to them. So they don't even think about it. So I'd imagine if we were to talk about taking an idea, making it smaller, you have so much experience with this at this point from both sides of it, that it just comes completely naturally to you to say like, oh, here's your idea. Oh, here's how you make it smaller. Here's the steps to go through, et cetera. And so there's a lot that went into that, though. There's so much that went into that. And so for today, for this episode, what I want you to do is just assume that everyone that is listening cannot do what you do that naturally. And so what we have to do is we have to dissect it. We have to rebuild it so that people can take it. So I'm going to take that superpower from you. And to do that, I need to start by making it personal so people can relate to this.
Yeah.
I need you to take us back to the moment where this first emerged for you, because you didn't jump into either entrepreneurship as an entrepreneur or entrepreneurship as a professor, just knowing that this was one of the principles. There's just absolutely no way, unless you first learn something somewhere or something happened. And so I need to understand, when did you first understand that this was something that you had to incorporate into your method, into your way of doing things, both in entrepreneurship and in education for entrepreneurship, of making things smaller, of kind of one, combining that with the dream bigger, but then also with the actual breaking it down, atomizing it. How'd that happen for you?
I will never forget the moment. I was sitting in Morgantown Coffee House, which is a little coffee shop near me, which, by the way, is like founder, kind of entrepreneur developed, founded thing. And I was sitting across the table from someone I knew who just finished chiropractic school. And he's like, I just signed a lease for $1,500 a month on a space where I can practice, and I have no idea how I am going to pay that bill. And he's like, can you help me? And I said, absolutely. And I said, I can coach you. We can get together once a month. I can help you to dream big. I can help you to start small, and I can help you build a money model that you can scale. And he's like, awesome. What's that cost? Off the top of my head, I said, $2,400. Basically it was like $200 an hour for like these 12 sessions. And he's like, great. Do you take Venmo? And he pulled his phone out. And I was like, wow. Like, I mean, I was like, that was a moment where I was like, I started so small. I literally just came up with the service like on the spot. I did a whole business model. He had a problem. I had, relevant expertise. I put a money model out there and he accepted it. Like, mm-hmm. That was the moment to start small. I didn't have a napkin sketch at that point. I met with him just to be like, a friend and a mentor. It didn't materialize until that moment. But I think that was the moment where I realized it's like, if you can find a person with a pain point and you can bring a relief to that pain point, and you can package it in a way where they understand what the offer is, they're willing to accept it, they're willing to pay for that solution, that's the fundamental building block of everything. And it was in that moment I went from, because I had worked in corporate. I was a corporate entrepreneur for more than 20 years. That was what I did. And so I understood the entrepreneurial process and all these things, but in this kind of context of an existing organization, this was the first moment that I stepped into, I'm starting my own business and I'm going to deliver value in a small way. And that was the moment where, I didn't even start. I always say to people, like, start your business with a Google folder, like, create a new folder, say my new business. I didn't even have the Google folder. I was just like, okay, here we go. Let's do it. And so literally my new business funded itself in that moment, because I had starting capital. And so I immediately went home and built a curriculum, and, it started it's like the solution came. But so that would be an example of just starting smaller can just be an inkling.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to have the right components in the mix. And they're what I just said. Who's that person that's got a pain point? What could you do to address that pain point? And how can you kind of make them an offer? Like, you know, how can they pay you in a way that's valuable for them and valuable for you that aligns?
Okay. So I want to go further back in your origin story now, because you're a corporate entrepreneur, 20 years, you said.
Yeah.
And you have this moment where the start small principle kind of births itself. And I need to understand more about, because other people might find themselves in that situation. Other people will find themselves in this situation and they will say, I don't know what to charge someone, or they will grossly undercharge. So you went with $200 an hour. There are people who would be like $25 an hour because they're like, no one will pay me for this because it's so obvious. Like, the things that I know, everybody knows. So why should I charge for it? This is a common thing. And so I tend to think of our abilities that you did that thing naturally of coming up with that on the spot of doing the math of 200 by 12 and thinking like, oh, I can help this person because you had the background of doing the entrepreneurship. I tend to think of our superpowers as falling into one of three buckets. And I'm obviously a huge superhero fan. And so it tends to come from one of these three things. Either you are a Superman type, you were born on Krypton. It's just a thing. It's in your cells. Like, you knew, you like were born with this in your DNA to ask for that 12 hours at $200 an hour. B, something happened to you. So at some point in your history, a la Spider-Man, you got bitten by a radioactive spider, something traumatic. You undercharged, or you overcharged, you dreamt too small, or you started too big. And then you learned a lesson that you carried with you forever and you would never let go of it. And that's like the something happens, something intervenes. Or there's like the training model. And to a certain extent, we are a mix of all of these, right? And you had 20 years of entrepreneurship to learn some of these principles, and that the training is like the Batman, right? Like, you're going to work at this thing until you know it and it's in your bones and you know 217 martial arts or whatever it is. So the question I would have for you is, if you go really, really, really far back and you break down yourself as a hero with this superpower, where does it come from for you? Do you think it's more of a natural ability to, in that moment, dream big, start small? Is it more of a something happened that got you to, in that moment, be that way? Or was it that all of those years of entrepreneurship led you to be that way?
Yeah. So I guess I'll have to say, and I know this might hurt you a little, I'm Spider-Man.
That's amazing.
That's something we have in common. I know. Like, I love that when we first started talking. I'm like, okay. Yeah. I was like, because part of me wants to say I'm Batman, but it hurts me because I'm a Marvel guy. But
yeah.
But you know, because I would say, like, most of my journey, like, I'm not Superman. I did not like come out with like special, you know, abilities or powers or like super intelligent. Like, I'm a grinder. Like, I, you know, I learn the thing, I perfect the skill, I just improve it all the time. But there was a moment, and there was a moment where I just had a fundamental change in my life. It was December 2007. My company was having a company like holiday event. And I was late as usual because I was in sales at that point. And so I was always used to like getting that one last sales call in before having fun. And so I was, you know, half an hour late. And I walk into the event, and I'll just remember the owner, the CEO of the company, Jeff Westfall, saw me coming in from across a room of like literally a couple hundred people. And it was like he pushed people aside and came up to me. And so the moment was, I was having a great sales year, and I knew I was personally having a great sales year. What I didn't realize yet was I was having the best sales year anyone had ever had in the history of the company. And so he approaches me and Jeff says, John, I'm like, congratulations. This is so exciting. You know, on behalf of myself and my family, like, we really appreciate all that you're doing. And, you know, and then he said it, he said, if there's anything you need, let me know. And I remember that statement just settled on me. And I was like, wow, someone who could own his own island just offered me a blank check. I'm like, what would I do if I had that blank check? And I got to tell you, like, I'm not the guy that'd be like, hey, can you give me 10 million bucks? You know, like, but it just got me thinking. And it was a fundamental shift in my entire career, because it made me think about, what if we took money off the table? And I, for whatever reason, I conceptualized this as $10 million. That was sort of the number in my head that, like, if I had $10 million in the bank, I would write my own course. you know, I wouldn't, you know, I, you know, cause I mean, I love my job. It was an awesome company. And honestly, I loved working with Jeff. And I, you know, and Penny Vennerholm and some of the other people that I work for there, and love that whole experience. But that was the number that was like, if I had this much money in the bank, I would chart my own course. And I'm like, what would that look like? And that was when I was like, well, I would want to have true expert knowledge. And, you know, there's one thing to have it. There's another thing to prove you have it. So like, to me, I thought, well, I would get a PhD because I had an MBA at that point. And I was like, that would be like kind of showing that extra level of expertise and that extra level of specificity in that expertise. And then, you know, I just started thinking about things I would do with my family. I would take my family to Europe for the summer, or I had all these different things that came to my mind immediately. Like, this is what I would do with my life if I had $10 million. Well, then I started backtracking a little bit, thinking, well, wait a minute. I don't need $10 million to get a PhD. You know, and so I immediately started talking to the company about they had a reimbursement program. I literally was able to get my PhD. It took 5 years. It was hard work with, you know, the company support. You know, I want to take my company to Europe, or my family to Europe for the summer. I was like, well, there's a 15-year program. At 15 years, you get a sabbatical. That was 2007. I'm like, okay, when I get to 2014, I can, and it was 2015 when it finally came together. It's like, I can take my sabbatical. I can take the summer off and take my family to Spain. And I did. My kids were between the ages of 5 and 10. We literally bought a car and sold it back. It was this crazy thing that we did. And we did Airbnbs, and we would move to a city or a town or an area for like 10 days. And like, then we would move on to the next one. And we had this experience this day. My kids are all like heading for college now, and they're like all talk about it to this day. And it's formative. I even look at like the trajectory of their lives. There are connection points to this trip. And you know, and then I had this thing of like, I would start my own business. I would help people that want to, you know, do what I would like to do, which is, you know, be able to take what I've learned and be able to provide value to others. And so, and then that was like, it didn't happen. I didn't like put a name on it. I didn't have that meeting with that chiropractor until years later, but, that was the moment. You know, it was like getting bitten by that radioactive spider. And all of a sudden I was able to create meaning in my work in a very different way, because I wasn't like going to leap the next day, but you know, it'll be more than 10 years before I made the leap. But 20 years actually. But it was like that moment I realized like I can create meaning in the work that I'm doing. And it's also contributing, building to something that's going to be in the future.
Oh my God. Okay. So you got me thinking about like traveling with my kids now. So
do it.
I went to Japan with them for like 10 days, I think.
I love that.
Back in 2024. And like, one of them was like 3 or 4 and the other was like just about to turn 2. It was amazing. But okay. So I want to talk about dreaming bigger, because I had a whole place I wanted to go with this. And one of the things that I do in this show is I kind of break down people's superpowers and try to codify it, but also your story is so damn good. I'm like losing myself in your story. so I want to pull myself back into it and start to break this down a little bit, because the moment where you started to think in terms of like, okay, if I had $10 million, what would I do? And you started to dream really big. And then you actually started to say, well, do I need $10 million to do that? And started kind of thinking smaller of like, well, what would it take to do some of those things? And that's just so like, it was such, that's so, it's a real grounded way that you did that.
Yeah.
When I talk to people about their dreams, when I talk to people about their purpose, their passion, the things that they want to do, what I've noticed is that people have a really hard time doing that. Maybe the $10 million exercise is the way to get there. I'm not sure. But, when you talk to others about the dream big portion of this, let's take the start small and put it off to the side just for a moment, bring it in as you need. But how do you get people to do that? How do you get people to dream bigger about whatever this thing is, so that it's not just like, I'm going to start, a photography business, or I'm going to, I'm going to have like this small business that I can run, but my life is actually going to be worse than if I stayed in my corporate job. Like, you have a very, very tangible set of things that you just laid out that you did in your head, PhD, traveling with the family, what it would take to get there, all of these different things. And then that set you up for later success, obviously. How do you now take yourself out of that and tell people, well, here's how you dream bigger. Here's the process to take yourself through.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a very specific process. I'm going to, you get to steal it all right here. You know, the first one is keep your day job. And you know, I think that's, it's a different scenario if like someone loses their job, you know, it's mm-hmm. like, we think about it a little differently. But the reason I say keep your day job is if you're thinking, I want to start a business, you actually don't know yet what it is. So, you know, I think some people like, you know, they kind of bet the farm, change everything, take the big leap and then figure it out later. I think that that's great if you're in your 20s and, you know, you're kind of responsible for yourself. It doesn't work real well when you're responsible for others. And so that's always the first thing I say. Number one, keep your day job, because, you know, until you know it, in some ways, it's like, it's almost like, you know, when it's time, it's when your clients are demanding more of you and paying you more than your day job. And then it's like, okay, time to leap. So, you know, that's number one, keep your day job. Number two, dream big. And I have two devices that, almost always work. Every once in a while, I'll come across someone with a certain personality where I have to kind of come at it a different way. But the first is the $10 million question. I always like really, really push, like, because a lot of times people like overthink the $10 million question. It's like, well, I probably want an annuity on whatever, so I'm going to take $8.5 million and put it into like savings. It's like, no. Forget all that. It's like it's the whole point is the exercise is, what would you want your life to look like? What would you do with your life if money was not an object? And I've had some people say, you know what, make it 10 million a year, or make it 10 million a month, or whatever you have to do to like make it where like that number means money doesn't matter. Cause to me, that was like a number in my lifetime. If you put all the money I make together and you boil it back to net present value or however you want to calculate it, like that's more than I would make. So it's kind of like, okay, take that money off the table. So that's really, in the entrepreneurial language, that's ideation. That's really saying, like, come up with lots of ideas for what you would want your life to look like. Or I had a professor in college who challenged me to write goals. And the only way I could figure out how to do it was I wrote an obituary for myself. And I literally have this obituary where I died on my 100th birthday in a freak skydiving accident. You know, and I kind of walk back and this is like my whole thing. And I remember at the time how ludicrous it all sounded. I literally like wrote my name with PhD behind it. I literally talked about, you know, running a, you know, going through kind of a corporate career for 20 years and like, you know, coming to like kind of the top of an, you know, some version of the organization, which, you know, I directed a division. And then I talked about making a major life change and going out and helping people. And I talked about family and how, you know, raising kids that were, you know, globally minded and confident and, you know, and really, you know, appreciated people and faith and, you know, and just accomplishment and all those kinds of things. You know, so I go through, I remember, and I lost it at one point. I remember in a move, I lost the actual thing, but it's funny to me now, cause I remember when I wrote it, it was almost like a joke, like, oh, like, you know, I think I threw Nobel Peace Laureate, you know, Peace Prize Laureate in there. I haven't gotten there yet. Probably won't, but it is funny to me. I look at it now, like it seemed ludicrous at 22 years old. And I'm like, I pretty well have checked a lot of those boxes, or at least on a path to. So that's where that dream big is, like, you know, just like ideation, $10 million question, whatever it is, like bring those through. And I have actually asked that question to almost everyone I've ever met in the last 10, 15 years since that moment. And so I've had hundreds of people, maybe thousands at this point, share with me. And so I've been able to kind of hear the way people process that. So that's the first one, is just, that's almost like in like, what do you want your life to be like? The second device I use, I call it the 100-year anniversary speech. And so this is, if you launched your business today, imagine 100 years in the future when you and everyone who was involved with it is gone. And it's been an outrageous success. And there's a banquet to celebrate the 100-year anniversary of this organization. And the keynote gets up to give their address and tell, like, show what this organization has meant to the world. What are going to be the three pillars of that speech? And so that's where I take, like, the $10 million question is a lot of like, what do you want your life to look like?
Mm-hmm.
And the 100-year anniversary speech is like, what do you want the world to look like after you've done this?
You're so on the right podcast, my dude. okay. So much here. I just wrote down like so many notes just from like that first one. That's what I'm over here when I'm like, I'm writing my notes. Skills. Okay. I need to talk to you about skills before we go into the next piece, because there's a lot here that you just gave us about the thinking, the mindset, the like the questions you have to ask yourself, some of the things you need to do. I want to go back to learning real quick, because I want to understand, if somebody's going to go into doing this, any kind of work to be an entrepreneur, what's like the foundation that you think that they need to both dream big and start small? Like, what are those kind of like minimum basic things that you think are going to be necessary to even make this all possible? Right. So if you're going to go out and try and do a thing, dream big and start small with it.
Yeah.
What are like, what's got to be on your utility belt just as your survival kit? Like, what do you need?
Yeah. You got to be a little bit visionary for sure. You got to be able to like see out in the future and see something that doesn't exist yet. You have to have tremendous grit. You have to be willing to do the reps, do the hard work, do the thing every day, put in the time, you know, deal with setbacks, you know, all those kinds of things. You know, resilience is a big part of that. And then the third thing is just the ability to adapt, like be flexible, like, you know, to be able to like to change, adjust. I actually find one of the hardest categories of founders to work with is somebody who's got this exact idea and it's exactly the way they have every detail figured out and they just don't want to deviate it for 1 second. I love biographies about founders. I love founder films. So you have been on my podcast, so
yep.
you know the question, like, what's your favorite founder film? I love those. Steve Jobs, one of the only ones I've ever seen that's been successful with that mindset. You know, Steve, for the most part, like he had a vision, he had it planned out to every detail and he refused to do anything different than, you know, no matter what anybody said. And it worked. His vision was so good that it was like, and you know, and I mean, he famously said, he's like, you know, our customers will know what they want when I show it to them. But you know, for the rest of us, I mean, and you know, honestly, like, you know, think about your superhero categories, like, okay, he's got the red cape, like, you know, he's from Krypton,
yeah.
You know, he had that thing that, you know, just, that's not how most startup entrepreneurship works. And I always say, and you know, it's always hard to say, like, I don't want to be the guy to tell somebody like, oh, your vision stinks, it'll never work. And then they later like, well, I'm a multi-billionaire now. Right. But for most of us, like the mere morals, you know, the Peter Parkers of the world, you know, it's that grind. It's the hustle. It's the determination and it's the flexibility, the willing to adapt to changing, very volatile and changing circumstances. Like those are the things that make for successful entrepreneurship. And those are, some of them are internal. Like I always kind of jokingly say you can't teach grit. I think you kind of can, but like some of it just has to be that internal determination. But a lot of it's skills. It's like everything else. And this is where like the Batman thing comes into place. Like, you know, he like Tony Stark had a big budget, so you can kind of, make up a lot with technology, but you know, it's that every day. It's like become a martial arts expert, travel around the world. Like, you know, it's like train every day, practice every day. Like learn how to use these technologies in unique ways or ways that people wouldn't think of or in combinations people wouldn't think of. Those are all part of the equation. That's the stuff that can be learned. It can be done. You don't have to have the red cape and the home address in Krypton to be able to make that happen.
Yeah, absolutely. And some of the skills I wrote down here that I pulled out that I thought were particularly interesting were the ability to look for problems, which you said is visionary. You have to build resilience because you have to be able to kind of keep getting back up. And then there's the adaptability and flexibility. All three of those feel like skills that you can learn. You can learn how to look for problems in a certain way. There are models for that. There are sort of frameworks. There are critical thinking skills that you can take yourself through. The resilience is really, that's kind of a function of putting yourself out there and doing that work and getting back up. And again, that's another place where starting small probably really helps. And then the adaptability and flexibility, again, is the sort of thing where sometimes that's going to be difficult. Maybe you need an accountability partner or somebody that you trust that helps you to stay adaptable and flexible. But I agree with every single one of those. So great advice there. And I think there's so much also that I've taken down that are just some like things we can learn from the things you've already learned. So that's a unique category in this show. I don't think I've ever really put out before. Let me ask you this. You just kind of talked about this before about like somebody's vision or somebody's plan that they have and they're really stuck to it. And also the $10 million question, right? You said something about, or the 100-year speech, you talked about kind of like use the word ludicrous. So there's a couple things here. One, which is, same question, but two dimensions of it, which is how big, how ludicrous do you tell people to be, but also, how do you tell someone whose dream is too big, or that might be like a little over the top, how do you How do you talk to them and kind of level set them without shrinking the dream, without crushing their spirits, so that they're both thinking big, but also thinking, I hate this word, realistically? Like how do you find that sweet spot, I guess? What's your method of communicating to someone about their dream and how they communicate their dream externally? Cause they have to share that dream with others to enroll people in, like, this business is going to be important.
Yeah.
How do you help people kind of find that bullseye?
So to date, I have never, ever told anyone to dream smaller.
Okay.
I just fundamentally don't see any value in it. I mean, history is going to say how big your, you know, how much of your vision you could achieve.
Mm-hmm.
But if, you know, if I tell somebody, you're dreaming too big, you need to cut that back. I'm basically saying to them, I don't think you have what it takes to achieve that vision.
Is this where the start smaller piece comes in then? Is like you say, here's the biggest dream. Okay, great. Well, where do we start with that? And let's pick something really, really tangible, because you never know if you keep at it. And, you know, sometimes you have success, the whole multi-billion dollar company sort of thing. Is that the connection between them?
You got it. You got it. It's like, dream as big as you can possibly dream. You ever seen the movie Cocktail?
Yeah.
One of my favorite founder films. And it is truly a founder film in so many levels. But I always say, in the movie Cocktail, we meet the worst entrepreneurship professor of all time, because he has everybody write a business plan concept and present it to the class. And A, not a single person in that class dreamed big enough. And B, he told them all they're never going to pull it off and they should dream smaller. And he was obnoxious about it. And he had people in tears. And he basically, finally, Tom Cruise's character calls him out and say, dude, you've never started anything in your life. How could you possibly know? Right.
Yeah.
And I think that was a film I watched when I was in high school. Like, it was formative to my just thinking about entrepreneurship. And I've always been like, when I got into academia, I'm like, I am never, ever going to be that guy. Yeah. I am never going to tell somebody your dream is too small or too big. I mean, it's just now. Cause I mean, think about, like, I mean, I guess, you know, talk about dreamers. We know Elon Musk, whether you hate him or some people love him, I guess, but you know, his vision is massive.
Yeah.
You know, it's like basically colonize Mars. I'm like, I mean, am I going to be the one to say, yo, Elon, you're thinking a little big there. You know, I mean, you're getting out of our atmosphere. You need to scale that back. Like, what value would that possibly have? You know, like, mm-hmm. So all that to say, like, I've never told anyone to dream smaller. I have always tell people to start smaller. And even when they say, okay, we can start here, it's like, no, start smaller. And it's like, mm-hmm. How about this? Still smaller, right? One of the early clients I had, in fact, the chiropractor introduced me to someone who wanted to have a coffee shop. And so I said, okay, how do you start smaller? I love that question. How do you start smaller? And so she said, so she went and did a bunch of research. She came back and said, I'm going to start a coffee truck. I'm going to buy a food truck. And I found one. It's only $90,000 and I'm going to turn it into a coffee thing. And it's like, I'm like, okay. Do you have $90,000? Not yet. Okay. Let's pause that idea. That's great. That's good. But how can you start smaller? And so we kept working our way back to the point that it was like, oh, a folding table at a farmer's market will cost maybe, you know, $25 for the table, $25 to like have the space, and maybe another $25 in, you know, a bag of coffee and, you know, a coffee maker and a couple crafts, you know, like, and then the challenge was, I said, okay, so don't even do that. I'm like, go through your calendar for the next 12 months and identify every day that you could dedicate to going to a farmer's market, setting up a table and selling coffee. And so, you know, and this is a person, and I had said, keep your day job or full-time job.
Yep.
And it was one that wasn't like traditional, like Monday through Friday. It was like some days were on, some days were off. So she, you know, made it kind of, basically identified like 76 days of available selling. And then it was like, okay, well, let's like, you know, a napkin sketch your, like, how would you set up your table? And what product would you sell and how much would you sell it for? And so it's like, okay, we got regular and we have decaf. It's like $2 a cup. And then, okay, it's like, how many cups do you think you sell in a day? It's like, okay, well, you need that many cups. You need that much coffee. You know, it's like, so like all that thought work was done. And then it was like, okay, like that's like the long-term plan. The short-term plan is like, okay, where's your first farmer's market?
Yeah.
And so she found a farmer's market. She went, she paid the $25. The first investment was $25 to get the right to the space. And then she went to Lowe's, bought a table. She went to, you know, she went to a coffee shop and just bought a bag of coffee and one regular one decaf. And then she, you know, she did like, she, so then she invested about $100-$150 to kind of that first day. And didn't quite break even on all of that, but by the second location had paid for everything that all the startup costs were basically covered.
Yeah.
And so it was 74 more days of selling, you know, on that model. So, so that when I say start smaller, it's like, because the dream is to have like a, you know, a high traffic location with a beautiful coffee shop that's like, you know, has Nora Jones in the background and like premium coffee blend and lots of different lattes with oat milk and, you know, like all that stuff.
Your own roaster and everything. Yeah.
Right. Right. You know, $15,000 espresso machine, the whole bit. So, so that's what I mean when I say start smaller. I mean, it's really like, how do you really boil this down to like something you can do for zero cost and for, you know, a short period of investment and time?
There's, so there's an interesting tension here between what I'm going to call in the categories, like the communication aspect and the action aspect, right? So in like the, you have to go out there and start doing a thing. It is like find the smallest first step, right? And then do the next smallest step and so on and so forth. Then the aggregate wins of that, hopefully. And you do some planning around that, obviously, to make sure that that's a good use of your time. So I like that on the action side. On the communication side, when you think about building a business, there is the, there is sort of a balance between just going out there and selling the cup of coffee and then selling the coffee and telling the people that you're speaking to about the vision that you have so that you can enroll them in that idea so that they can support it, right? And so some people will have a retail idea, something where they sell a product of some sort, but a lot of people may start a service business. And in that, they have this bigger vision of what they're trying to achieve, who they're trying to help. And this is nested inside of that dream big, right? And so I'm curious how you advise you know, these accidental entrepreneurs, these small, getting their feet wet, they may have a day job, they're doing a thing. How much of the big dream is incorporated in the way that they talk about it with others as they're doing it? How do you get them to find that bullseye? Because you may not tell them to dream smaller, you may not tell them to start larger, but somewhere in there, there's a middle ground where it's like, well, I may just be selling a cup of coffee today, but here's the dream. How far, how many steps ahead should they be thinking of what they're talking about there? How big? Because when we dream big and we tell people we're going to change the world, people are like, okay, sure. Yeah. Great. You, right, good luck with that. Right. But if you're like, hey, I'm going to get a coffee truck, right? Like, okay, well, it's like that's in your future potentially, or I'm going to start a nonprofit, or I'm going to do this. But like those feel like, okay, that's a thing that's tangible, but people don't realize the big, big dream until they see a medium-sized dream take shape. And so how do you help people to understand the communication challenge of finding that space between the small start and the big dream?
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I mentioned that original curriculum. I eventually evolved that into a program I call 21 Days to Launch. Mm-hmm. And so this is where, you know, you have the, you can privately start a business. That's different than publicly launching a business. And so that, and you know, even 21 days is pretty ambitious to like kind of go public. But I actually think, I mean, we live in a world where building in public is actually the thing, because, you know, stories sell dreams. And so, you know, it's like in a lot of ways, the creating the story and bringing people along, getting them attached to you as a founder and your story, that's a big part of how you get it started. On the flip side, you have to sell what's available today. And so part of starting smaller is, you know, if you open a coffee shop, you're addressing a lot of different problems and pain points, a lot. I mean, you probably could unpack 100 different value propositions from a coffee shop. If you're selling cups of coffee at a farmer's market, you're essentially solving one problem. And I used to, one of my traditions when my kids were little, we went to the local farmer's market every Saturday. It was open from like early spring to like late fall. We'd be bundled up, whatever, raincoats, didn't matter. And I would like arrive. And one of the first things I did is I would go to Twin Valley Coffee, which is now a massive business, by the way, massive company. I think 4 or 5 locations. They have a huge wholesale online business and everything. But they were in farmer's market mode at that point. They had these beautiful like burlap bags and wooden crates. And, you know, they did a couple of different coffee drinks. But to me, it was like, I arrived. It was like, I was tired. We just woke up. The kids were all scattered to their various parts of the farmer's market that they wanted to see. And I wanted to kind of experience different things with each of them. And kind of like, so we would all kind of just wander in this area. So my first stop was always at Twin Valley Coffee, because it meant that I could enjoy a cup of coffee while I was also enjoying the farmer's market. I love coffee. And so that was sort of a connecting point for me. And I knew the founder and they were friends. And so like, it was also kind of part of my community experience. So, but for the most part, it was one value proposition: is I wanted to enjoy a cup of coffee while I was enjoying the farmer's market. So with that value proposition, there was one table that sold coffee. It was maybe $3 for a cup, and I like it black, so I didn't go for anything special. And so that was it. You know, it was like, that was one simple value proposition. And so that's where part of it boiling it down is, you know, they weren't talking about locations. They weren't talking about wholesale distribution. They weren't talking about online presence. They weren't talking about their own special blends of roasted coffee or any of that at that point. They were like, hey, it's 8:30. We got a cup of coffee for you. I'm like, excellent. Right. So that's part of the starting smaller is really getting there. And then this is where I think it's important to talk about failure, because that's where you want to fail. In that simplest, like, card table and 2 crafts of coffee and nobody buys it or whatever. And you're like, why didn't anyone buy it? You know, like,
yeah,
I want to fail there right now. I $150 investment, one day of my time. I lost
no employees,
no employees, nobody bought anything. No, you know, no, what, you know, all those things. I want to fail right there. That's where I want to fail. It's like, okay. What's wrong? Is this a group of people? Am I charging too much? Am I charging $4 a cup and I should be charging $3 a cup? Is this a group of people? Like, am I in a town that like doesn't like coffee? Is there a coffee shop at the front of the park that everybody gets their coffee at before they, you know, it's like, you know, you can start to, you know, figure out like the reason for that failure, learn from that failure and do something about it quickly. One of my favorite classes to teach in the university is called Ready, Set, Fail. And it's really a life resilience course. It's disguised as an entrepreneurship course. But you know, it's setting yourself up to, like, first of all, don't set yourself up for a big fall. And second, like, have a way to get back up quickly, learn from it, move on. And I really liken it to gymnastics. Like, my youngest son's really into parkour. He goes to a parkour gym. He has like a coach and he's doing all these like crazy flips and turns. And like, I'm exhausted after 6 minutes of watching him. I'm like, I'm about to have a coronary, and he's like got an hour and a half in front of him. And like, you know, but like some of the things, it's like one of the first things they did with each move, they teach them how to escape. They teach a somersault maneuver. Like, okay, today you're gonna put your palm facing down and you're gonna flip around. And if you land wrong, you're gonna break your neck. So the first thing they do is they're gonna, like, okay, from this position, push and then roll. And they have them do that like 10 times until like that's like that. So they're like, if you get to here and it's not gonna work, you do that. You know, and it's like, so it basically taught them how to do this somersault so they don't break their neck when they fall. And that's what I like to do with early entrepreneurs or those studying entrepreneurship is, okay, how can we like create some fail situations that are really, really simple, really, really safe, and let's do it over and over and over again. And that, and start smaller, and iteration gives you that opportunity to like, let's figure out, how do we bail out of this? How do we bail out of this? How do we bail out of this? It's like fail, 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 recover, fail, resilience. You know, like you have this sequence. And then now it's like, okay, we're starting to have some success. How do we build on that success, knowing that the next level of build means there could be other failure opportunities, but now I have some practice. I know how to fail well and how to get the most out of that fail.
So we're about an hour into this show, and I know for a fact that I could talk to you for like 4 more hours about this. And there's a reason why you have an entire curriculum around this, but like, it's such a fascinating subject to me. And like, it's so interesting to hear you talk about it because, you know, I've been doing this a long time and I think about it a lot. And, you know, I have bits and pieces of this that I teach to people and coach people on. And it's like, it's just so interesting to hear your perspective on it. What I'm going to try and do now is I'm going to try and recap what I've learned from you today. and some of the big lessons in the framework that I call the superhuman framework. It is the one that follows the pathway of the meta abilities of learning, thinking, communication, and action. And that if we learn how to do those abilities more effectively, we can actually grow and learn almost any new ability. And so what I was listening for throughout this conversation is, what are the things that you learned? How did you go about your learning process? What was that like? How do you think about things? There was a gold mine there, and there's so much that we could have covered. And then, you know, how is it that we communicate to effectively do this thing that we're doing? And then what sort of actions do we need to take? So there's so much there. So I'm going to recap what I heard, knowing full well, and full disclosure for all the people listening, that there are a gajillion additional steps here. Before I do that, I do have to call out one ADHD thing that just happened as you were talking about farmers markets, which is that, and I never get the chance to do this, but I have to do it because it's one of my favorite companies ever. There is a peanut butter company. So I love coffee and I love peanut butter. They're like two of the components that create a me.
Throw in bacon and I'm sold.
Oh my God, yes. So there's a peanut butter company that is out in, I believe, Trevose, it's something with a T. I forget where they are, but I buy their peanut butter every day. I eat their peanut butter every day, but I buy it whenever I'm down a jar. It is a company called Nutty Novelties, and they started at farmers markets. And I first got a jar of their amazing peanut butter in like a little gift basket that somebody got me of like local products. It's made in PA, and they make a honey roasted habanero peanut butter, and they make a honey roasted peanut butter. And the two of them are just, the texture is unrivaled. I will die on this hill. It's the best peanut butter in the entire world. And they started at a farmers market, and now they're in Acme, they're in Giant, and they're like expanding, and God, they deserve it. And they're such nice people. And they're like still a small family team that runs it and everything. And just got to give them a shout out that they are an example of like, we're just going to make some nut butters. And then now they have all these different amazing flavors and they deserve all the success in the world. And if you ever want to talk about their peanut butter, I'm always happy to talk about it.
Accidental entrepreneurs. They dreamed big. They started small. That's such a great story. I love it.
Yeah, it's awesome, right? Okay, so here's what I gathered from you. I'm going to look over at the notes that I have. So first, I told you there were some things that I think are like learning from your learnings, right? And I think there's two categories in here, one of which was sort of like, this is good advice. And the other is kind of like, keep that in mind. So one, keep your day job. Like this is such a good one that I think if you're going to dream big, starting small means don't leave yourself without a parachute, really. Like have that safety net in place. Don't leap until you're making enough money from your side hustle that you can give up your day job. So keep your day job. The second one is you can make up for a lot with a big budget. You said that. I thought that was so funny. And it's true. A la Batman and Tony Stark is like, well, if you have enough money, you can kind of get away with a lot of things. And I would also add in, and you'll appreciate this, the Spider-Man principle of that, which is that, well, if you do have that money with great power, there must also come great responsibility. So dream even bigger than and try to make more of that impact. Really focus on that that 100-year speech. I think that's an important principle. Learning. I think from the learning perspective, the three that I heard most is that you have to learn how to be able to look for problems that people are having that are in the market right now. I think that's the core of entrepreneurship. What do people need? Oftentimes you are going to be your own best customer. We build the businesses we wish existed, but also get out of your bubble, talk to other people, listen for problems, and go looking for them. The second is to build resilience. This is going to dovetail back when we talk about action, but you got to get out there and start actually doing stuff. And that's going to help you to build that resilience, because so much of this, if you're going to dream big, you're going to get knocked down. You're going to fail. You got to be able to get up. And the other part of that is being able to adapt and be flexible. So from a learning perspective, if you're going to have a curriculum to focus on, learn how to look for problems, learn how to build resilience, and learn to be flexible. Thinking. This was such a gem. This was such a gold statement. You said, you don't know what your business is yet. And that, I've been doing this since 2011, and I still don't know what my business is at all times. It is not a set thing. It's an amorphous thing that's constantly adapting to the conditions and is getting better over time. It's iterating. And so in this start small principle and keeping your day job, like, you don't know what it is yet. So give yourself the opportunity to not know what it is yet. And as far as the dream big side of things, there are two things that I think are related here. One is ask yourself that $10 million question. And the thing that I took from that is that it's not a question of what would you do with $10 million? What business would you start? It's what would your life look like? It's actually not about the business itself. It's about what would you want your life to look like? Because that's, I think, the thing that will actually motivate you. I don't think it's motivating to think about, you know, the $10 million company. It's It's thinking about your $10 million life, and your trip to Spain has got me thinking about all the things that I want to do. I have some things like that on my list. Communication, two things that I took from that. One, sit down, write your own obituary and dream big. I think about my obituary or my eulogy a lot. Like, what would people say at my funeral? I think about that a lot. And one of the things that drives me is like, we don't have a lot of time here. So like, make the time count, right? So I think that that's a really interesting way of communicating your dreams sort of to yourself, to the world, and giving you like a thing to look at as a destination. And then the second thing that you said, well, I thought was really interesting because I do a lot of brand work, is talk about where you are and the value proposition you solve now. And maybe you could talk about the thing that might be coming next as you're planning it and getting ready to do it. But it doesn't make sense when you're at that farm table, the farmer's market coffee table, to talk about your five locations if you don't even have the one, right? So talk about where you are, know in your head that big dream. But even with the communication, it's like, start small. Talk about where you are and maybe what the next thing is. Yeah. And that leads us to maybe, the action. Yeah.
Well, one quick thing with the communication, I was remiss to not say this, like build the mailing list. So like, you know, build that following. So like, if you're at the coffee thing, it's like, hey, you get 10% off if you like, give me your email address, like just build that and then be able to like, keep telling that story. Cause like that being able to communicate with that audience over time is huge. So anyway, just,
So that's also, so it's like, one, talk about where you are, but also talk to who's there. Right. Yeah. So like, communicate, this is another thing that like, I mean, a whole tangent about this, but we look at these big numbers. We want to have followers of a million. Right. But we don't talk to the 10 people that actually are there and care about what it is we're doing now. And that's a mistake that I see happen all the time. I try not to make it, because when people support what I do, I'm just like, it's amazing. But we get so hung up on the big numbers. So I think that's another great communication principle, is like, talk to the people that are right there. Now, the two pieces of action that I think tie this all together, everything that you're talking about, that you've talked about today, I think really does anchor in action. And that is, start small, ask for less, try a smaller experiment. And because the second principle of action there is that you want to fail early and small. You want to get all of your failures out wherever you are. But if you start small, your failure is smaller, and you want to put yourself in positions to have those failures, and you want to pick things where you can learn from the failure, right? So like, don't just fail for the sake of failing. Fail toward something so that you can learn from it and adapt. Those are all the things that I took away from, and so much more, but these are things that if I was going to like try and break it down, I'm up to 10 bullets here. I almost never get up to 10 bullets. But there's so much in that. Is there anything that you feel like, oh man, Jeff, that's a really good framework, but you totally left out blah. Anything else that you think is missing from today's conversation on that?
Yeah, I think the one thing I would say is missing, was probably missing in what I said, not your ability to catch it, is just, the formal terms, customer development, customer engagement. I think we sort of touched on it with customer, with communication. It's, if your customer's not in the loop, you're building a hobby for yourself. And so, you know, to me, it's like, you know, you mentioned like those 10 people that are listening, that's gold. Because if you have 10 people that are listening and they're like, I really want I love your story. I love your product. Your solution addresses my pain, whatever it is. If you have 10 people that really feel that way, man, spend as much time as you can with those 10 people and give them free stuff. I mean, if you had to, like, whatever, you know, just keep them engaged and listen to them, because that, you know, the big thing of like customer development is really empathy. It's asking questions. It's observing, you know, when they're experiencing you. It's telling them your story, getting their reaction to it. It's showing them your new product. It's, you know, sharing your vision and say, what do you think? I mean, this is a big giant vision. It's going to take me 10 years. And you know, and they're like, well, this town's not going to support five locations. There's only like, you know, 200 people in the population. You know, you get those like kind of candid feedback from those people that really want you to succeed. And they're also going to be the ones be like, hey, I got an idea that could be like the next big thing that you hadn't even thought of. So I think that would be the only other piece, is just always stay close to customers. And whether there's 10 or 10,000, it's like, make sure you're talking to them every day.
And there's such an interesting nugget in there as well, which is that as a communication principle, if you're talking to the people who are there and staying close to them, and as the customer development, one, and this is sort of like advocating for you, don't dream any smaller, always dream the biggest. The people you talk to are going to be the ones that always are going to either crap on your dream, or they're going to support it and tell you to grow bigger, right? Or like, oh yeah, you can absolutely do that. But their criticism, their disbelief in it is also a clue for something you can learn from. It's always a thing where they're like, to your point, like this town's not going to probably support five. Like you could have that vision and think that's what it is, but maybe that's telling you, oh, you just need to spread across multiple towns or something, right? So they're going to find the flaws in it from their perspective. And sometimes it's valid, sometimes it's not, but it's data, it's information. And then they're also going to give you some new ideas that you maybe never thought of. And the last thing I'll pull from that also is that when you stay close to those customers and you listen to the things that they say, you actually get the language that they use, not the language that you use. And when you start using a customer's language out in the world, you're going to actually find that it's attracting other people that have that same problem expressed in that same language. So I think as another communication principle, staying close to the audience, you can learn from them. You can understand how they say things, and then you can use that to adapt your plan and learn along the way. This has been absolutely bonkers, amazing. I could talk to you again for honestly hours and hours, but, thank you for coming on to Rogue. Thank you for letting me steal your superpowers. I do hope that it was not too draining. Please tell listeners how to find you when Gotham is in trouble.
Yeah, absolutely. Gotham's in trouble. Go to my YouTube channel. It's Entreprofessor on YouTube. You will find me there. You can reach out to me at entreprofessor@launch-grow-thrive.com. And I'd love to connect. Also, I'm on like LinkedIn and some of those other areas as well. Substack, also Entreprofessor. So anywhere you find Entreprofessor, you find me, branded, registered, trademark and all that. But I'd love to connect, and happy to like jump on a quick call and give some quick input. And I have communities if you want to go deeper. So
amazing. I promise I will make sure every bit of that is into the show notes as well. And for all the superpower listeners that are listening right now, I hope you're not done growing, and we'll come back for the next episode of Rogue. I'll be talking to another superhero to learn about and steal their superpowers. And as a reminder, if you join the Superhero Institute, we have something called the Rogue Gallery, where I take conversations like this and I break it down into a PDF that you can just download as sort of a cheat sheet for how the superpower works. This has been an episode with Doc John, the Entreprofessor, and I've been Jeff Gibbard as always. And until the next one, please keep doing your part to bring about a world that is kinder, safer, and more equitable. See you in the next one.
Rock on.